Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
Well, there are, I think, in a lot of ways, more unanswered questions than answered about the terrorist attack on Bourbon Street. And the other thing is that there are some big, giant events coming up in the city. With that, we're joined by Gina Ligon, director of the National Counterterrorism Innovation, Technology, and Education Center, NCITE, at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Is it Dr. Ligon?
It is. I'm the director of INSITE, which is the Department of Homeland Security's Academic Center for Terrorism Research, and we're headquartered at University of Nebraska.
Let's talk about terrorism. A lot of people tend to think that it's all automatically associated with radical Islam, which it can be, but it's not always that, right? Or not even the majority is that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, any radical extremist religious extremism is some of the most lethal, and there's lots of different religions that can inspire it. But yeah, I mean, we've seen an increase, especially since, honestly, October 7th and the increased tensions of Hamas and the conflict with Israel. And so an increase in that kind of inspired attacks based on that sort of violent interpretation of that religion.
But it's not necessarily religious. It can also be political. Does it skew one way or the other recently in terms, and does the COVID lockdown have anything to do with this, Doctor?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, in the U.S., most of the security apparatus has talked about that actually white supremacy is the most lethal kind of ideology that inspires homegrown terrorists in the United States. And so, it ranges from lots of different belief systems. And I think what we get most concerned about as terrorism scholars is really when people feel like they have to take on violent acts to enact whatever those goals are, whether they be political or religious or, you know, even to your point, issue specific, like, you know, climate change, that could also be one that you're going to see an increase in.
Yeah, or abortion or any social issue, it could be, right? Where people get, they feel, and that's where we get to the psychology of this, and that's what I want to really get into. How does somebody go from, and in this case, and there's so many questions about the Bourbon Street terrorist, but, you know, having financial setbacks, having trouble with the marriage, whatever it was, then from there, it seems to me, and I'm just a dumb guy, Doctor, but I'm being honest. I would think, well, you know what? I don't want to take responsibility for my own problems. I want to blame it on somebody else. So then I'm going to go find somewhere to blame it. And then I'm really going to swallow all of it that I can. And then I'm going to exact that anger and that revenge on somebody that has nothing to do with my problems. Am I even close to anything there or not?
You know, you really just summarized it really well.
Really?
And one of the things that these groups overseas have done just a masterful job at is sort of helping people tie their personal grievances to something bigger than themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people have financial trouble or divorces, but when they also have this interaction with, they start consuming this material online, they realize that, you know, they can, you know, kill themselves, hurt other people in a way that seems to be more glory-filled, if that makes sense. Mm. Like, it seems to be tied to a higher purpose.
Glory-filled. That's how you said gore. I got you. Glory-filled. Yes, exactly. Like they're serving it's not just about me. Now I am doing something grand almost to make up for my failures on a personal end.
I think that's it, especially when you look at this person's background. It's kind of a textbook case of radicalization because he, you know, started, you know, first experimenting with, he converted in 2022, became more of a devout Muslim, I would say, in 2022. And that's not what it takes to become a terrorist, right? But what I think was also interesting is you saw that he started isolating himself from people who weren't who he saw as devout. And so then you're cut off from all your social supports and people that might actually help you reinterpret, you know, feelings that you have. And so I think all of those things sort of combined with his financial struggles and then consuming this propaganda really kind of propelled him down that radicalization pathway.
When it comes to radicalization, which is the boat and which is the dock? Do radical groups go out recruiting people or looking for people that are in dire straits, or do people that are in dire straits or have problems go looking for radical organizations?
I mean, unfortunately, we're seeing both, right? There's no doubt that there is a concerted effort to recruit and try to find people who could be vulnerable. Especially, you're seeing a lot with young people. With the unmoderated sort of gaming platforms, you have all types of extremists that are trying to reach in and find people to help them be part of something. But I think, you know, from everything we've seen in the FBI files of the attacker in New Orleans, he sought them out. There was no direct recruitment of him, at least from reporting that I've seen. He's the one who really found their websites and tried to understand operational manuals that they had put forth. And so he looked for it.
So I know you guys have done case studies of this, I'm sure. And it goes back to the old thing, Doctor, where individuals are unpredictable. Groups of people are predictable. What are some commonalities when it comes to all radicalized terrorists, I guess, whatever the cause?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really interesting. Department of Homeland Security has these things, suspicious activity indicators, mm-hmm. and it's really more based on the mobilization part. Because here's the thing, in the United States, you can hold all the radical beliefs you want, right? Like, right. We have First Amendment. We're able to, you know, express our beliefs, freedom of expression. But it's when people start mobilizing to violence on behalf of those beliefs, there's some more commonalities around that that I think are important for people to really understand. You know, one of them is, you know, isolation from previous groups. And, you know, that alone is not a predictor. But when you start looking at it compared, you know, combined with all the other things, you know, I'm just reading about his operational planning, even around the Mardi Gras parade. I don't know if you all are reporting that, but the FBI released a report yesterday that talked about he was actually researching balconies that he could get access to during Mardi Gras this year. Mm-hmm. So when you start doing that kind of operational planning for violence, that there are indicators that are more common for radicalized violent ideologues like him.
What are some other commonalities?
Obsession with violence. So you saw one of the things that he did was he every time for the past 3 months leading up to it, when there was a shooting in New Orleans in the city, he would research it and try to find out as much as he could about it. So, you know, why was a guy from Houston researching shootings in New Orleans? Mm-hmm. There's even evidence that he had a Google alert for it. So he wanted to know every shooting that happened in your city. The other piece I think is interesting is, you know, obsession with previous attacks. And so you saw him looking at, if you remember the vehicle ramming in Germany that was 10 days before his in New Orleans.
Market,
and
I think it was.
Markburg. And he researched everything he could about that, read every news story he could. And so that's another one, his obsession with prior attacks a predictor of that. And then also, I think it's combined with his radical beliefs and isolation from people that were former sort of social supports to him. So what we look for is a change in behavior, right? So you saw a distinct change that started happening in 2024 when he became like really interested in the violent extremist content associated with Islam and not the simple religious doctrine associated with it.
So how do you balance that with the rights that we have in America, rights to privacy, rights to freedom of expression, and people that want something like this prevented? Because as you said, Doctor, I can go online, I can say anything I want within reason, I guess. You know, there are some words that, some things that will get me in trouble, threats, etc. But also when it comes to changes in behavior or trying to organize people, I don't know how you would go about even as a with the Department of Homeland Security and from a psychological standpoint, trying to predict this, trying to follow this, trying to prevent this.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if all of it is a law enforcement approach, right? Like if we're trying to arrest our way out of it, we're not going to succeed with this new way that the Islamic State and groups overseas are sort of inspiring attacks here. Like you just can't, because we have civil rights and civil liberties, and it's hard to know when people make that shift from holding an extreme belief to wanting to take on violence on behalf of it. So one of the things that I think is pretty cool that DHS has done, and actually I looked right before the call, New Orleans has one. They have these regional prevention coordinators, and they are people that are really trying to prevent people from ever wanting to mobilize to violence. So it's not like a law enforcement approach. It's more of a off-ramps, you know, helping people understand like how to provide supports. You know, maybe if Jabbar's family had encountered any of those programs, and they're in place in Houston as well, they would have, you know, had some tools to be able to off-ramp him from this, as opposed to like having to arrest him, because he, you know, people that probably didn't have probable cause to arrest him, you know, as, according to our First Amendment rights.
So when it comes to the internet, naturally the internet facilitates most of this, right? That was the game changer when it comes to radicalization and terror groups reaching out and finding individuals, or individuals reaching out and finding terror groups.
Yeah, and I honestly think it's on behalf of the foreign terrorist groups of recognizing they could change their propaganda to what we call enable terrorist attacks. So it's not just inspiring them, right? It's not just like talking about radical violent beliefs, but it's actually giving them operational manuals and making people feel like they have the ability to carry out these attacks. And so we call those enabled attacks. So there's, you know, three different categories. There's inspired, there's enabled, and then there's directed. And I would classify him as enabled, because he, it looks like what he was doing was actually looking at operational manuals, not just, radical sermons and things like that. Like he was getting some what we would perceive to be direction, but not from a person, just from the materials.
So I'm trying to – I have so many questions here, and not specifically about this Bourbon Street attacker, because I know that the investigation is ongoing. But when it comes to locations, for example, why would somebody choose not to engage in – well, you know, and I'm going to make it about New Orleans, Doctor, and I don't mean to, but just as an
analogy. No, it's fine.
But as an analogy, it's like why would he pick New Orleans? Why not do something in Houston? Why do terrorists pick the locations, and how do they go about that? Is there a commonality there at all, Venn diagrams?
Yeah, that's a great question, because like if you just look at it straight from like a criminology perspective, like the way criminologists think about crime, usually you would want to there's a theory called routine activities theory, right, which is you're more likely to commit a crime in a place that you have routine contact with, because you have more expertise in how to carry it out. He traveled there, right? And, you know, used the meta glasses to be able to scope it out. He thought about renting an apartment. If you saw on Orleans Street, he did all these things to try to develop expertise with your city. So I thought that was interesting. One of the things that if you backtrack about terrorists, they're trying to get attention for their cause. And so New Orleans, you know, obviously on New Year's Eve would have a lot of people, and he knew that it's a symbolic part of America. And I think that's also important for us to remember, is that at the end of the day, he didn't do this quietly, right? He wanted people to cover it and do it on a day that would get the mass media attention. And so I think, you know, most of them do try to choose not only symbolic targets, but also targets that will get a lot of media coverage.
And as we have this conversation, it pops into my mind, maybe he did know that the Super Bowl was coming. Maybe that's that he thought he'd get more publicity that way. Maybe as you talk about Mardi Gras, I knew that was coming up. Maybe he thought that would get more publicity. I still wonder why he waited until 3:15. I don't get that part. But let me get more to the social media sites. And we hear so much about algorithms and the internet. Do they play a part in this? If somebody goes to look for a tweet or a video or research, like we talked about the Christmas market attacks in Germany, I think it was, then do...
So it's a new year, 2025, and you're thinking, how am I going to make this year different? How am I going to build something for myself? But where do I start? Shopify is how you're going to make it happen, and here's how. Shopify makes it simple to create your brand, open for business, and get your first sale. The best time to start your new business is right now. Get your store up and running easily with thousands of customizable templates, no coding or design skills required. All you need to do is drag and drop. Their powerful social media tools let you connect all your channels and create shoppable posts and help you sell everywhere people scroll. What happens if you don't act now? Will you regret it? What if someone beats you to the idea? Don't kick yourself when you hear this again in a year because you didn't do anything now. With Shopify, your first sale is closer than you think. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to start selling with Shopify today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Is somebody able to track that? And then they say, well, you know what? This person is obviously interested in this, so let's reach out to them and try to radicalize them.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, like from a, like, let's just talk about it from a police interdiction standpoint. Mm-hmm. Like when a lot of Americans, not a lot, but when an alarming number of Americans were wanting to travel to go fight for the Islamic State, you know, there was collaboration with the tech companies about, like, for example, on Google search engine, if people would type in how to get to Syria cheaply, right? That was one of the main routes that people would want to get to go fight for the Islamic State. And so, you know, the dangerous organization's part, and they did have one at Google at the time, was able to redirect those people into different places where they could talk to people that maybe could off-ramp them or give them some other resources to support them. So, you know, we do get smart about search histories and, you know, trying to be able to use it to off-ramp people when we see some sort of known patterns. But I think what's hard about, you know, Jabbar, for example, is that he, you know, he was, you could have just chalked it up to curiosity. He wasn't doing something that looks so like, oh, this is definitely someone who wants to attack. It could have just been someone who was interested in New Orleans, right? Which a lot of us are. So, yeah, I think when it's a very commonly used search term, yes, there are definitely triggers that can help with interdiction and surveillance. But oftentimes, and it's just a needle in a haystack, just like we talk about.
And I just wonder if from the other angle where I'm, you know, okay, let's just look at what happened at the market in the Christmas market. And I keep watching it and watching it. And then some nefarious actor sees or is able to access the data that I'm watching. And they say, well, you know what? If I'm recruiting somebody to become a terrorist, maybe this person would be subject to that. Does it happen that way as well?
Yeah, most of them are not as sophisticated to be able to like track the metrics of who's looking. Mm-hmm. But here's what they do is when you like things, like, for example, if you follow accounts or you even just like a news article or write a comment, that there is evidence that that certainly can trigger recruiters to target you and start sending you more material. The other is in those unmoderated spaces that we talked about, like Telegram and channels that are in, you know, when you join those chat rooms. I haven't seen any reporting about him that he was actually in any of those. But if you're in any of those, that can also be a way that they can try to recruit you. And there's, you know, there was a whole apparatus from ISIS, I mean, doing that where they were recruiting women and Westerners to want to come over and be part of that just by like how their behavior was online.
I got a text that comes in here, Doctor. We have a thing where people can text in their thoughts. And somebody said he was radicalized by a religious sect that hates America. Why isn't that the main point of discussion? Mm. And I think that that's what the discussion is about. He went to the religion or the radicalized religious sect that hates America because of his issues, not the other way around, correct? I mean, that's the point we're making here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not a linear pathway, unfortunately, but there are sort of like, I would say kind of like levers that are operating all together, right? So that's the risk factor you pointed out at the beginning about his financial troubles. Also, you know, wanting to be part of something bigger. I mean, there's evidence of him wanting to join groups, as you saw with his military history. So he no longer had a group, and so he's lonely. And then he finds this, you know, radical interpretation of a religion. And, you know, that's the problem, is you can make any belief system radical, you know, and that's an issue that we struggle with as terrorism researchers. You may have a belief about climate change or the way the government handles, you know, state rights or gun rights. But, you know, when you start deciding you have to take on violence because of that, that's when you become what we would call, you know, an extreme violent ideologue. And the ideology could be anything. It could be religion, issue specific, political. People can contort all kinds of things to justify violent action, and I think you're seeing that with him.
Can social media companies inadvertently make this worse by feeding you more of what you like, going back to the algorithm thing where, well, they're not necessarily nefarious actors. They're just, you know, the algorithms are showing what you like, so they send you more, and then before you know it, like, you know, use the old cliche of the frog in the water, where before you know it, you're suddenly radicalized because you kept getting fed, you're being fed all of this stuff over and over and from more and more sources.
Yeah, and I think especially if you don't have any other sources of contradictory information, right? Like, you saw him isolating from, you know, people that didn't have those extreme beliefs. And so you're getting this consumption due to algorithms of things getting promoted over and over again. You're seeing the same TikToks or Instagram reels over and over again, and you no longer have that support group to kind of bring you back and pull you back to being less extreme in that interpretation of Islam.
Doctor, I hope you come back, because we never have enough time, but I do have to ask this. Once somebody goes down the rabbit hole and becomes radicalized, is there an off-ramp to that, or is that it?
Gosh, I have to believe there is, or I wouldn't be doing this, right?
What has the research shown and success rates?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a really cool book called Walking Away from Terrorism. It's by John Horgan, and it's all about different kind of disengagement or off-ramp pathways. But, you know, I have to go back, and part of this is probably because I'm a psychologist, but, you know, having what we call intimate partners, friends and family, social networks, number one, recognize the change in behavior and some of these risk factors. But then number two, help pull you back without a law enforcement kind of option, right? So it's more about like bringing you back into the fold socially, as opposed to trying to, you know, call the police about you or call the FBI about you. When you see cases like that, we call that a better pathway for what I would call disengagement, maybe, which is different than de-radicalization, because I just want them to disengage with a violence. You know, again, I live in Nebraska, and I'm a, you know, First Amendment protected. Like, you can have all the extreme beliefs you want in America, but if you act violently on behalf of them, that's when you become a concern to public safety. And so I just want them to disengage from the violent interpretation and sort of the operational manuals about how to mobilize to act out.
It would seem like once law enforcement gets involved, it's almost too late.
I mean, you say that, but like, you know, one of the things that I wanted to point out was, you know, there's been 23 attacks that have been in last year that were stopped by different parts of law enforcement that were inspired by the Islamic State. And so, you know, America doesn't hear about those as much.
Yeah.
They have, you know, law enforcement has to be right 100% of the time. But this guy, you know, got through, but
I think that's the
stopped quite a few.
A very good point, Dr. Ligon, and that is that we don't know what we don't know, and we know about the ones that fail, but we have no idea about the ones that were stopped, right?
Yeah, you can kind of get a sense of it from arrest records. That's one of the things that we track is, and you know, sometimes they roll them up on charges like gun charges or pornography or something not related to terrorism. But that, you know, because they just want to get them off the street and get them out of, you know, harming Americans. And so they're going to look for whatever crime they can prosecute. So the number is kind of an undercount. Like a lot of times the media doesn't even pick up on it because it's, you know, so-and-so was arrested from a big cache of weapons that they were, that they had. And you might not think about that with terrorism, but in all actuality, that person was maybe consuming extremist propaganda. And we didn't hear that part of the case.
Doctor, did you write a book about de-radicalization or not?
No, I have not. But you know, in our consortium, we fund a lot of research looking at like how you reintegrate people back into society after they've been part of groups. So we are definitely trying to put the full court press on trying to understand how you pull people out. Because I think that a lot of us, unfortunately, know people that perhaps have changed their behavior in terms of, you know, consuming more extreme beliefs. And so what can we do as parents, as siblings, as, you know, friends to pull people back into the fold so they don't, you know, go down that hole of getting engaged in violence?
And the book you mentioned was Walking Away from Terrorism by whom?
His name's John Horgan. He's a really prolific terrorism researcher, but he's interviewed a lot of former extremists from, you know, Salafi jihadists, all the way to like members of the IRA and like how they got out of terrorist groups. And so I just find that really hopeful because you can kind of start putting patterns together. But I think the common denominator is having that social network to pull you back. And so if anything, you know, just giving your listeners that efficacy to, you know, that we all play a part in our public safety and to not, and if you have that kind of spider sense, trust it, you know.
Doctor, I can't thank you enough for your time. I hope you come back and have another conversation with us because I can only talk to you for about 20 straight hours about this. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for covering it.
Hope you come back. Thank you, Dr. Gina Ligon, Director of the National Counterterrorism Innovation Technology and Education Center at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, who incidentally has the initials UNO. 9:35, 25 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We always do this every year. We talk with the executive director of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. We're very appreciative of everything that law enforcement does. And with that, we welcome in Rosa Gwixens. Did I say that right, Rosa?
Yes, Gwixens. Yes, sir.
Gwixens,
thank you
executive
for having me, Tom.
Thank you. Tell me about the numbers of 2024 as far as law enforcement deaths compared to 2023?
So sadly, once again, in 2024, we saw an increase in line of duty deaths. We had a total of 147 line of duty deaths, which is a 25% increase from 2023. 52 of those 147 cases were gunfire-related fatalities, which is also an increase of about 13% from what we saw in 2023. That does not include the number of officers. I just like to point this out. It doesn't include the number of officers that were shot and survived and shot at. So it's a astounding number. The highest number of officers that were killed due to firearm related incidents was while they were doing traffic enforcement or trying to arrest people or serving warrants.
I just want to point out for a second there, Rosa, for people that think there's when they get pulled over by the police, you know, everybody's nervous there. You're not just the only one that's nervous, the law enforcement officer. And when you look at 9 killed just during what was supposed to be a, quote, routine traffic stop or trying to make an arrest or even serving a warrant or eviction, the officer doesn't know what's on the other side of that. And people need to keep that in mind, right?
100%. We have no idea who we're pulling over, what's in the vehicle. You know, the time of day also helps, whether it's daylight out or night out, especially in the evening, if tinted windows, we can't see inside the vehicle. You know, and I tell my children, the side of the road is not the place to argue. That's what court is for. So just be respectful, do what you're told, follow directions, and everything will be fine.
And along those lines, officers do get, and I try to make it as safe for an officer when I get pulled over as I can to pull as far over on the road and to give him as, or her as much room as they need. That's a very dangerous thing as well, is it not? Traffic-related?
Well, actually, yes, it's crazy that you mentioned that in particular, because that's where we saw a 113% increase in our fatalities, which is the struck by category. And we struck bys are what we refer to as when officers are out of their vehicle, either off their motorcycle or they're just not protected in any way. They're standing on the side of the road, and that could be directing traffic even. But we had a 113% increase from last year. 17 officers were killed as struck bys, which is terrifying. I mean, speed kills. People are driving distracted. People are driving impaired. People are not minding move over laws, and it's killing a lot of police officers.
I know that I once helped a lady change a tire on the side of the interstate, and I was Catholic at that time, and said like 15 acts of contrition. So I can only imagine what y'all go through. Let me take a break, Rose. When we come back, I want to talk about the other causes of death, and I don't want to focus on the anomaly as much as just the dangers of being a law enforcement officer that I don't think people realize. And we'll talk about that. 49 other causes of death in 2024, traffic-related deaths. We talked about 52 firearms fatalities. And the numbers, I'll give you the total, the most frequent, I guess. Traffic enforcement was at the top, then making an arrest. Civil papers are serving warrants or an eviction. Investigating suspicious persons. 5 ambushes. 4 were handling domestic disturbance calls. 4 were killed during technical encounters. 3 were killed in accidental and inadvertent shootings. 2 investigating disturbance calls. 2 were off-duty robbery intervention where the officer was off-duty. 1 was shot in a vehicle pursuit. We'll talk about the other causes and the dangers of law enforcement. To law enforcement when we return. 947, 13 till 10. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, quickly back with Rosa Gwixens, who has 30 years in law enforcement. She's the executive director of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. We've been doing this maybe 10 years now, talking about the number of deaths in law enforcement when the numbers come out, 2024, seeing a 25% increase in law enforcement deaths compared to 2023. Rose, if we can quickly, we only have a couple of minutes left, let's get to the other causes, and I'm not trying to cite them as anomalies, but only to show how varied and dangerous the role of law enforcement can be.
Yes, thank you, Tommy. So in that category, the cases that are included in those are the long-term illnesses that are related to the 9/11 terror attacks, any acute medical events that are brought on by extreme stressful events, and then a variety of other rare incidents like electrocution or any fire-related case. Actually, the state of Louisiana had 2 physical-related, so I'm going out on a limb and just saying it's probably some sort of heart attack, cardiac type of medical event. There were 36 total for 2024. Then 4 drowned. A few of those were actually training incidents. So they were training for whether it be to get into a specialized unit or whatever the case was. 4 were beaten to death. 2 were in an airplane crash. 2 were stabbed. 1 was a fire-related incident. And 1, as I mentioned, was an electrocution. So it's certainly, it's a variety of incidents that fall in that category.
Thank you so much for the time and for the work that law enforcement does. Rosa Gwixens, Executive Director of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. I hope when we speak next year, there is a decrease in 2024 compared to 2025 compared to 20. You know what I'm saying. Thank you, Rosa. 954 back in a flash, WWL.